damaged or suffered setbacks as a result of this year-long sanctions campaign. And obviously that would be good for the election that's coming, because then the government can say, see, it was the sanctions that made life difficult, and now we're recovering. And so it's all its own electoral strategy to get the opposition back in power.
Thank you so very much, Jose Luis. Sorry to cut you off. I really want you to come back so we can talk more. We've got to go now, but thank you. Thank you so much. Please join us again and have a wonderful rest of your day.
All right, you too. Happy to join you.
Thank you. Thank you. We are out of time, folks. Gosh, all good things, though, must come to an end. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator for today, Gary Baca, and assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
No matter where you are, everyone is always connected.
Spark Plug. Stunning. New sounds every other Wednesday, 3 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. Join us and get connected.
Emma's Revolution. My name is Shay, and I'm the Divest from the War Machine organizer with Code Pink. Welcome to the Code Pink Radio Show. Check out our website at codepink.org/radio, where you will find all our episodes from episode 1 to our most recent. The COP27 UN climate meeting is happening in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt now, from November 6th until November 18th. They are going to be discussing at the conference the possibility of wealthy polluter countries helping pay vulnerable nations for costly extreme weather events fueled by climate change, a proposal that the United States has already resisted. Also at the conference, they will not be discussing the United States military, as it is quietly exempted from the talks, which is a shocking omission given that the US military is the planet's biggest institutional producer of greenhouse gases on the planet. Egypt's treatment of political prisoners, among other things, makes this a troubling conference and an important one to watch. Listen on to learn more. I'm going to turn it over now to Marcy and Medea of Code Pink.
All right. We are now going to start our program. We're going to go to Jim Ryan of Veterans for Peace, who I've gotten to know over the last year or so. A great organizer. He says he doesn't say he's an activist, but I think he is. He's a strategic thinker. Jim Ryan is the co-founder of the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project. Prior to that, he spent 35 years as a research geologist. He also served in the U.S. Army in West Germany from 1970 to 1973. Jim is currently an adjunct professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Geology at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, and working to organize protests to address the problems with COP27. So, Jim, you're on.
Thank you, Marcy, and thank you to Code Pink for allowing me to say a few words. So the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project has been working for over a year trying to educate folks, both environmentalists and Veterans for Peace members, about the links between military and climate change. Now, just recently, we've gotten another component, the Stop the War, Save the Climate sort of wing. Jim Driscoll has sort of headed this up. It's actually a project that's getting veterans out there risking arrest to stress the links between militarism and climate change. It's getting some of its funds from the Climate Emergency Fund, which has been sort of in the news recently, or at least some of the projects that they're funding have been in the news. They're somewhat, they're helping out the art demonstrators or protesters like over in the UK with the Van Gogh paintings and the protests there. We're gonna be involved in a protest in Washington, D.C. on Armistice Day, the 11th. We're gonna be also doing an action on the 14th in New York City. And we're going to be hopefully doing an action on the 16th in Boston. You can, if you go to our Climate Crisis and Militarism Project website, which is at Veterans for Peace, you can see a listing of those projects and the contact people. And again, what we're trying to do, these actions are going on during COP27, is to try and stress to everyone that the military missions need to be reported to the IPCC, to the UN. That's going to be one of the themes, especially in New York. We hope to protest outside of the UN headquarters. So that's essentially a few words about what we're doing.
Thank you so much. Jim Rhine, one of the co-founders of the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project of Veterans for Peace, and they're online. They have a terrific website that Janet Wheel has worked a lot on, and she's going to give us another update on COP27 and what the environmental movement is doing about that. Janet is a military family member. She's a retired adult educator. She serves, as I mentioned, on that project. She also edits the newsletter and blog for Extinction Rebellion in Portland. Welcome, Janet.
So this is a reminder of what the U.S. and NATO are providing to the Ukrainian government and military now. And, you know, it does meet the definition, the dictionary definition of proxy war. I was somewhat alarmed to see yesterday that the 101st Airborne of the U.S. Army, otherwise known as the Screaming Eagles, and very famous or notorious for what they did in Vietnam, is on standby 3 miles from the Ukrainian border. So, Marcy, you wanted me to talk, though, about COP27.
Yes.
Correct, yes. Okay. So, so probably a lot of people on this call have read the very powerful article by Naomi Klein stating her principled opposition to the way the Egyptian government and the authoritarian leader Sisi in particular are using COP27 for nationalistic greenwashing and grandstanding, as indeed the U.S. and other nations will do as well. However, and also Greta Thunberg is another famous no-show, as is King Charles III, who's been told by his government not to go, despite his decades of concern about these issues. However, Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis will have a representative from our project there. And in fact, I just got a long email from Cindy Piester, our rep at COP27 in Egypt. So the reasons to make the effort to get all the way to the Sinai Peninsula, where COP27 will be held in a very expensive tourist resort, is obviously to have a presence at the annual international gathering that includes all nations negotiating on climate issues and goals. Primarily for Veterans for Peace, this is an international opportunity for us to push our call for counting and reducing military emissions in national emissions reporting to the United Nations. This is something that the US government, and in fact, precisely the State Department, worked hard to prevent during the Kyoto Protocol negotiations in 1997. And we must be able to count all emissions in order to be able to see where they're coming from and reduce them. This is a great opportunity for Cindy to network on our behalf with other organizations, such as the Climate and Environmental Observatory, or CEOPS, in Britain. They'll also have representatives there. Support calls for human rights and justice, and build awareness of the relationship between these existential crises of global militarism, including the increased threat of the use of nuclear weapons now, and of course the climate crisis. So in the lower right, I have put the logo for the COP27 Coalition, which is a people's coalition of many, many groups, primarily led by African climate organizers and groups, demanding, among other things, peace, negotiations, and climate justice, and loss and damage payments from the global north to the countries of the global south, and global south debt relief are also key demands. So if you haven't yet, I really recommend you checking out the COP27 Coalition. Here in Portland, Oregon, where I live, we are going to have a rally during the COP on the Global Day of Action, which is November 12th. And you don't have to remember all of this. I'm kind of motor mouthing through it. I will be sending Marcy a resources list, which she can share with people on this call.
Great.
And the other thing that I want to point out is that at COP27, there will be the putting forth of a proposal on the national level. I believe Costa Rica is going to be the country to put this forth, that the UN stop excluding military pollution and specifically greenhouse gas emissions from climate agreements. And World Beyond War has been pushing this petition. Probably a lot of people attending this call have signed it, and we're very grateful to World Beyond War for their support. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Janet Wheel, with Veterans for Peace. Great information there to learn about the coalition. Code Pink also has a petition, and we'll be sharing that later on in the program. And this is a petition also to stop excluding military emissions. Teddy Ogborn is Code Pink's coordinator for our War Is Not Green campaign, also called WING. They are a climate activist and coordinator based in New York City. Originally from Littleton, Colorado, Teddy earned a BA in comparative literature from Haverford College. Before working at the intersection of climate and anti-militarism, Teddy has worked as a film festival director, a fencing coach, a film producer, and a high school English teacher in France. Teddy, so glad you could join us tonight.
Thank you so much, Marcy. Yeah, great to meet you all. Teddy, they, he pronouns. I've very recently started working with Code Pink, so I'm very excited to be here at my first Code Pink Congress. I am the coordinator for War Is Not Green campaign with Code Pink. So I wanted to quickly touch on why we have this campaign and what it does. So the dominant rhetoric around climate change and climate change action really focuses on industry and industrialization. And while there is so much organic overlap with the military, as many of us here know, that rhetoric oftentimes doesn't seep into our calls to action within the climate movement. So part of my job is to, as a climate activist here in New York City, ensure that that conversation is had and that that connection is made in all of our demands, because the groundwork is already there. These arenas are hardly distinct. So anti-militarism and climate action are such natural allies as to be almost a perfect circle of Venn diagram, right? So our goal and my job in this campaign is to be incredibly loud about that and to make sure that's clear. Part of that, as a little update from New York, that I've seen in this last week and helped organize, was our Occupy Park Avenue campaign, working in coalition with New York Communities for Change, Extinction Rebellion, and Sunrise Movement. We held an entire week. Many people on this call, I'm sure, saw some snippets of that news reporting on that. On Monday, activists disrupted Ted Cruz on The View. SNL even did a little sketch on that. We held arrestable actions blockading locations on Park Avenue at BlackRock, which is the world's largest asset manager, a ginormous funder of both fossil fuels and private military contractors, as well as Blackstone, very similar as a private equity company. This last week was incredibly encouraging for me as a wing coordinator, and that we had so much success tying these issues together, and for people to see, you know, the vast expanse of the consequences of these, both the billionaires that we were highlighting, spotlighting, if you will, as well as the corporations that we focused on, like BlackRock and Blackstone and JP Morgan Chase. Looking forward to the future, as Jim mentioned, we are collaborating. We just had a call earlier, collaborating on this Veterans for Peace action in New York. That'll be on November 14th. Details for that will be on Code Pink's events page, but I'm very excited to do that as well at the UN and for this partnership to move forward as well with climate organizations here in the city. So just to touch more about the issue at hand when we're talking about the WING campaign and war, and, you know, war is not green, emissions in the military, both in the US and globally, we all know that we need to be dedicating far more funds to combating climate change, whether through green infrastructure and also for defending the most vulnerable communities who are on the front lines of climate change. And we know that right now that money is not enough. Right now, one of our biggest obstacles is the ginormous opportunity cost we're facing here in this country, where annually we dedicate $800 billion to funding and fueling the planet's largest single emitter of fossil fuels. It's actually a double opportunity cost in that way, right? It's committing us to further carbon emissions, methane emissions, and all of that money, $800 billion, should be going towards safeguarding our communities and our planet against climate change. So this is a huge and daunting task, and is the goal of this campaign. Some more facts on that subject. In 2022 alone, the US will spend 2 times per day the amount of money on military than it does in an entire year on climate change. That obviously needs to stop. As I said, the Pentagon is the largest single institutional emitter in the US, the largest emitter as a military in the world, an institutional military in the world, emitting over 100 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year. It emits more than most countries on the planet, our Pentagon does, which is a staggering fact that when I tell people oftentimes in the climate movement, they are surprised by, even though they are so well-educated on many other facets of the climate movement. Globally, militaries are responsible for 6% of all greenhouse gases, which is an enormous portion. And as I said, the Pentagon, our own U.S. military, holds a huge amount of responsibility to that. And as such, it's been estimated by climate scientists that no real meaningful progress can be made on climate change if we do not curb military emissions immediately. Dr. Neda C. Crawford, who is a preeminent scholar on the subject, having written the book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, has written that we are locked in a cycle of acquisition of fossil fuels and the production of that acquisition. We all know that to be true in our involvement in the Iraq War and in the Persian Gulf. And it's a deadly cycle that we're currently locked into that needs to be broken immediately. Even if we do choose to argue, if someone chooses to argue for U.S. militarism outside of the context of climate change and as though we need the US to secure to be a secure nation. That's also a ridiculous claim. There's a whole suite of arguments to be made against that, in that climate change makes our nation so much less secure, and we are seeing that all of the time. 10 years ago was Hurricane Sandy. That's what Occupy Park Avenue was meant to commemorate. We had 43 deaths here in the city that wouldn't have happened had the storm not been exacerbated by climate change. And it's estimated that $8 billion more damage was caused by the storm than it would have had we had not, had there not been anthropogenic climate change influencing it. Unfortunately, the US military has actually long been aware of the impact of climate change, but only within this context of securing national interests. In the 1950s, Pentagon scientists were well aware that the Arctics were warming, the Arctic Ocean was warming as a result of fossil fuels, but this was only framed as a threat because it would allow the Soviet Union to then navigate the waters north of us, right? So we're in this paradox where this hugely funded institution in our country, and what gives American politicians this idea that we have the right and the might to police the world, is actually making us so much less safe. And so part of our goal here is to break that paradox, to speak logic to this chaos, and to end military emissions. The obvious solution would, of course, be to count military emissions among those that we are trying to curb and cease via the Conference of the Parties, the COPs. But as has been alluded to earlier, and we'll talk about more, that is not the case right now. Military emissions are currently exempted completely from discussions and agreements at COP, which, given everything that I've just shared, is absolutely absurd. It locks us into a climate-changed future and disaster for our species and the exacerbation of tensions globally. Some context for past COPs. So as was mentioned before, in 1997, during the formation of the Kyoto Protocol, the inclusion of military emissions was proposed, but in a last minute decision, it was yanked out of the agreements. And since then, that tradition has stuck, even after the erstwhile aggressive agreements made during the Paris Accords. So that continues to be the standards for COP. And COP oftentimes fails us in this way. And that is why people are so jaded about it, right? I believe it was Janet earlier mentioned that, you know, Greta Thunberg this year is choosing not to come to COP because she has witnessed time and time again how world leaders there greenwash themselves and greenwash this conference while making no meaningful progress on climate change. So Greta Thunberg is making a really powerful and brave statement as a climate leader by not showing up to COP. And that makes sense. COP oftentimes features corporate interests and in business leaders who are funding and fueling and enriching themselves off of climate change and fossil fuels. Larry Fink of BlackRock was a recent speaker at COP. And he's platformed so much more than, for example, indigenous communities. And this year it's sponsored by Coca-Cola, right? So there's so many reasons to be jaded by COP. And for all the people that are making their voices heard and calling this out, it is our responsibility to make COP matter, right? This is still the single greatest avenue that we have between nations to come together and find real solutions to climate change and anti-militarism at the same time. And so it is incumbent upon us to seize on that opportunity. Code Pink has done, Nancy Mencius with Code Pink has done some really wonderful work these past years pushing for talks on military missions to actually enter into the agreements at COP. And those efforts have been rewarded hugely last year, after last year, with this year military emissions being a part of three featured side events at COP. So now these aren't the main events that will result in agreements around emissions, but it's a big step. And the many voices globally, including Code Pink's, that have been calling for this, has seen great success in securing these side events. And obviously we need to continue pushing, right? So that military emissions are a part of those main agreements. And that is what our petition for, which I believe Medea will be presenting later, that is what our petition is for, to demand that military emissions are counted in these agreements so we can actually de-incentivize militarism globally and we can meaningfully address climate change. So I'll stop there. Again, thank you so much for having me, and I'll pass it along. Thank you.
Thank you, Teddy. Welcome to Code Pink. You know, I'm inspired to know that Code Pink and these other, the coalition members, are organizing these side events to focus on this, because we know that sometimes social justice movements operate in silos, you know, and people in the climate movement certainly need to be brought into the anti-militarism movement and vice versa.
Thank you so much to Jim Ryan and Janet Will of Veterans for Peace and Teddy Ogburn of Code Pink. Listeners, you can follow Veterans for Peace at VFP National on Twitter, and you can follow Code Pink at Code Pink on Twitter. You're listening to Code Pink Radio. We will be back after this break with Sharif Abdel Kudos and Mohammed Ismail.
The table about to turn. The table about to turn. The table about to turn. Yeah. I've been flipping through my timeline, trying to get my mind right. My city cried out. I got to cool down, but I'm under pressure. Cooking with my Crisco. Look at what my fists go. A renegade when I'm in a rage. I got to cool down, but I'm under pressure. I keep my hands dirty, my mind clean. Got a new agenda with a new dream. I'm kicking out the old regime. Liberation, elevation, education. America, you a lie. But the whole world about to testify. I said the whole world about to testify. And the table's about to, the table's about to. Kitchen, then you should do the dishes. Burning down plantations. Ain't no parking, I don't need no validation. I light sage when I'm in a rage. I don't need permission, I got my intuition. Hands dirty, mind clean. A different vision with a new dream. We kicking out the old regime. Liberation, elevation, education. I said America, use a lie. But the whole world about to testify. I said the whole world.
Welcome back, everyone. That was Turntables by the incredible Janelle Monae. I'm Shay, the Divest from the War Machine organizer with Code Pink. You're listening to Code Pink Radio. We're now joined by our next guests, who will speak to the police state presence, an aspect of this year's COP27, Sharif Abdel Kudos, and then Mohammed Ismail.
All right, so Medea, you're going to introduce our next guest.
Yes, after those great presentations, now we're going to move into the police state part of COP27. I was so shocked when I heard that Egypt was going to be the location of COP27, given how incredibly repressive that society is. And we all know that the COP meetings have been characterized by very vibrant demonstrations outside and inside the meetings, and that's not exactly what one can do in Egypt. So we're really delighted and honored to have as one of our guests tonight an old friend, Sharif Abdel Kudos, who, as Marcy said, is known to some of us from his time at Democracy Now!, but he has been an independent journalist based between New York and Cairo, and has reported from across the Arab world for a number of print and broadcast outlets. He's a part-time editor and reporter at Mada Masr, Egypt's leading independent media outlet. Sharif, we're really glad you could join us tonight.
Thanks, Medea, and it's good to see you. And thanks to Code Pink for inviting me to speak today. I think what would be useful is to just first paint kind of a very quick overall picture of what the repressive state looks like in Egypt, and then maybe focus on the COP itself. So as many of you know, the 2011 revolution, which was very inspiring and led to and reverberated around the world with the Occupy movement, Indigenados in Spain, in the UK, really across the globe. That revolution was followed by a very harsh and brutal counter-revolutionary wave, which kind of the revolution was crushed in 2013 by the military and by then General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, with a reinvigorated police and security apparatus taking over. So right now, Egypt's controlled by a very tight and closed ruling circle of military and intelligence officers that is completely opaque in its decision-making process, does not allow for any political participation, does not brook any kind of dissent or opposition. It seems that the government's answer to any problem with the citizen is prison. There are quite literally tens of thousands of political prisoners in Egypt right now. We actually don't know the number of detainees because there's no official statistics, and this forces lawyers and the very harassed human rights groups to try and painstakingly try and tabulate the thousands of people who are trapped behind bars. Over the past several years, we've seen Egypt build several dozen new prisons. Just last year, Sisi announced the establishment of the Wadi Natroun prison complex. Well, it's not called a prison complex, it's called a rehabilitation center. This is one or of seven or eight new prisons, which Sisi himself dubbed as American-style prisons. These prison complexes include within them courts and judicial buildings, so it kind of makes a conveyor belt from the courthouse to the prison cell more efficient. You know, the majority of political prisoners in Egypt are held in what's called pretrial detention. And under Egypt's penal code, you can spend 2 years behind bars without ever being convicted of a crime. Nearly everyone who's held in pretrial detention faces these kind of two identical charges, one of which is spreading false news, and the other is belonging to a terrorist organization or an outlawed organization. Prison conditions are very dire. If you get sick, you're in trouble. There's been a lot of deaths because of medical negligence, with prisoners dying in custody, torture and other forms of abuse by the security forces is widespread. We've also seen the number of death sentences and executions skyrocket in Egypt. So under Mubarak, the former president, in his final maybe decade in office, there was a de facto moratorium on executions. No one was really being, there was death sentences, some of which were being handed down, but people weren't really being put to death. Now Egypt ranks third in the world in the number of executions. And we've also seen a massive crackdown on press freedoms, a near complete takeover of the media landscape. So under Mubarak, there was at least some opposition press in newspapers and some TV stations. But now the regime very tightly controls the press through censorship and also through acquisition. The General Intelligence Services, which is the intelligence apparatus of the military, has become the largest media owner in the country. So they own newspapers and TV channels. And independent journalists, like the place that I work from, Adamas, we operate on the margins in a very, very hostile environment. Egypt's the third largest jailer of journalists in the world, and it imprisons more journalists on charges of false news than any other country in the world. So basically, you know, yeah, the regime, you know, sees any citizen really as a nuisance or a threat. And any forms of protest or public assembly are banned. They carry very stiff prison sentences. We've seen mass arrest sweeps happen whenever there's any kind of public demonstration. And we've also seen an unprecedented crackdown on civil society, with human rights organizations and economic justice organizations being forced to scale back their operations or operate really kind of underground. The people who work for them are subject to intimidation and harassment and travel bans and asset freezes and arrest and prison. And finally, Egypt's become a massive purchaser of weapons. It's the third largest, I think the last count, it was the third largest importer of weapons in the world. So we import more, we're the number one importer of weapons from France, number one from Germany. We're the second largest recipient of military aid from the United States. And all of this is happening while the country is kind of on the brink of economic collapse and defaulting on its foreign debt. So after that kind of rosy picture, I think we, you know, it's very important. It was very disheartening for a lot of people in Egypt who work for human rights and justice and forms of democracy when Egypt was granted the right to host the Conference of Parties, the UN Climate Summit. Egypt's trying to position itself as the voice of the global south and one of the lead negotiators to unlock billions of dollars a year in climate financing from the global north. Of course, this issue of reparations is very important and needs to be discussed and needs to be taken seriously. But, you know, how can we have reparations to a country like Egypt when you don't know where the money is being spent and it's mostly going to be spent on kind of bolstering this repressive state and one that's essentially a polluting state? You know, as Naomi Klein put it in that great article that was mentioned before, the summit's going beyond greenwashing a polluting state. It's greenwashing a police state. So I think what we can expect at the summit in Sharm el-Sheikh is very carefully managed theater. So, you know, as was mentioned before, we all know the problems with the UN Climate Summit, rarely amounting to anything getting concrete actually happening, with kind of a lot of climate negotiations happening and climate diplomacy, but they are also very important convergence points of dissent and convergence points for different groups to come together in the climate justice movement. And you have protests always inside and outside the conference. This will not be the case in Sharm el-Sheikh. Okay, so Sharm is a resort in Sinai that literally has a wall around it, can be very tightly controlled, and it will be. There's actually the space that's been designated for protesters is built, from what we understand, it's a purpose-built area out near a highway that's away from the conference center or any other signs of life. So, you know, holding a protest there, I don't know if it'll actually be effective. And actually, you know, this is, from what I understand, why Greta Thunberg is not coming. She has problems with the structure of the COP itself, but even this ability to use it as a convergence space for dissent, that's effectively shut down. But more importantly, the members of Egyptian civil society, the allies, and environmental groups that are critical of the government will not be in attendance. Those that manage to be will have been vetted by the government and will have to be very careful in how they operate. The others are either, these are the people that are in prison or subject to various forms of legal repression and harassment. And, you know, in a departure of normal UN rules, all the local partners that are being allowed to attend the COP have been vetted and approved by the government. The conference itself is going to be very highly surveilled. So the government created this app that, you know, you can download to use as a guide during the conference. But to do that, to use the app, you have to put your full name, your email address, your mobile number, your nationality, and your passport number, and you have to enable location tracking. I don't know why anyone would do this, but I think you'd be surprised the number of people who would. And Amnesty International technology specialists have reviewed the app and flagged all these concerns about surveillance and its ability to use the camera and microphone and location data and Bluetooth and so forth. But I think what people need to also understand, what's been happening in the past week alone, we've seen an intensified crackdown and a massive arrest sweep in the run-up to the climate summit. Hundreds of people have been arrested, by some counts, 500 or 600. They've been arrested off the streets, from their homes, from their workplaces. Scores of them are being held in pretrial detention on those terrorism charges and being added to what's been dubbed the climate revolution case. They're being questioned about a supposed protest. There's been calls for protests. It's unclear where they started, but I think from people outside of Egypt, for November 11th. So it's the 11/11 protests. And everyone in Egypt, all these people are being arrested and asked about 11/11. Are you going to take part? Who is organizing it? And so forth. There's a massive security presence in Cairo and other cities across Egypt. Police are stopping just random passersby. And this has happened before in times when they panic a little bit, forcing people to bring out their phones, unlock their phone, open Facebook, open WhatsApp, and they look through it. And if they find political content that they find problematic, they arrest you. So this is happening right now as people are preparing to come to the COP. just the other day, actually, and you know, it's not restricted just to Egyptians. There was an Indian climate activist who was detained in Cairo just the other day. He set off on this like solo climate justice protest march, and he aimed to walk several hundred kilometers to Sharm el Sheikh. He was held overnight and detained and questioned for several hours. He called an Egyptian lawyer friend. When the Egyptian lawyer friend came to the police station, they detained him and held him overnight as well. So this is kind of the environment that we're coming in. And I mean, I can speak more about maybe later about Egypt's kind of the military's role in you know, pollution and all of these things. But I just want to end in this segment to talk about, you know, all these government officials and delegates and members of international civil society groups are coming to Sharm el Sheikh. Egyptian civil society has not called for a boycott, but they have called for human rights for, and specifically for political prisoners, to be at the heart of the negotiations. For these things to be linked, we can't ignore them. And there's thousands of political prisoners like Abdelmenem Abdel Fattah, who's a former presidential candidate, a blogger called Mohammed Oxygen, Mohammed Bakr, who's a lawyer, Marwa Arafa, who's an activist from Alexandria. But I just want to end also on the case of Ala Abdel Fattah. Ala is probably Egypt's most famous prominent political prisoner. He's been behind bars for much of the past decade. He is in prison for his ideas and for the versatility of his mind. And because he's come to represent change, he's come to represent, he's an icon and a symbol of the 2011 revolution. And I think imprisoning him for the regime is seen as setting an example for everyone else. And that's why there's been a lot of campaigning around him, because to get him out would also represent some kind of real change. Ala has been on a hunger strike. So last year, Ala, I can talk about his prison conditions maybe later, but he had very, very difficult prison conditions. You know, 2 years without a book or any reading materials of any kind, wasn't allowed out of his cell, didn't even have a mattress to sleep on, just completely deprived of anything. And he for the first time expressed suicidal thoughts. But on April 2nd, he decided to go on hunger strike as an act of resilience to protest his imprisonment and to call for certain things. So he's been on hunger strike for 7 months now. He started with a hunger strike, just water and salt, which is a style of hunger strike Egyptians learned from Palestinians. And then in May, he was transferred to a different prison, to this Wadi Natroun prison, the rehabilitation center. And there, his conditions improved a little bit. He got access to books and so forth. And the campaign for his release, he decided to go on a Gandhi-style strike and ingest 100 calories a day. For an average adult, you need 2,000. So it's very meager. He takes like a spoonful of honey in his tea. He's been doing that since May. But he just, in a letter to his family the other day, said today was his last day of doing that. So he's gone back to a full hunger strike. And on November 6th, on the eve of the Conference of Parties, on the eve of the UN Climate Summit, he's going to stop drinking water. And so the body cannot last without water for more than a few days. So he is basically organizing us. He's making us, everyone outside, act, because he will die in prison. If he's, either they release him or do something, or he will die. So this is something I think everyone needs to really keep in mind. I think it's a very brave act what he's doing, that when everyone's gathered in Egypt, this is going to be happening. He's using his body, the only thing he has agency over, to organize. And he's organizing us on the outside who can do something, whatever that something is. So I'll just leave it there and we can discuss more later.
Thank you, Sharifa. I was getting chills listening to you.
So Mohammed Ismail is a dear friend for many years. We've been working together on the issue of the Egyptian government's tremendous repression that Sharif just outlined for us. And thank you, Sharif, for that incredible presentation that's chilling, shocking, disgusting, especially knowing how the U.S. is supporting this. And Mohammed has been instrumental in creating a group called Egyptians Abroad for Democracy, and is working with Egyptians around the world trying to change the Sisi regime. Mohammed, I don't think you had a time to hear Sharif, but he did give us a great overview. And I would like if you could tell us what you think people should be doing in the U.S. to try to change U.S. policy towards Egypt.
All right. Thank you very much, Medea and Marcy, for having me. I heard a very good part of Sharif at the beginning and the end, and he very much covered it all. I just want to say one thing about Allah. Allah also said, I'm holding accountable the international community in general and holding accountable Sisi for Sisi and Great Britain for letting him die in the prison. Go back to your question again. I think that we, the American citizen and in particular Code Pink members, we need to use the letter that Code Pink signed on it and ask, since Biden is giving a credit anyway by visiting Sisi, his Trump's favorite dictator, at least to make the visit conditional. We have a lot of leverage in the United States to free the 60,000 plus prisoners if we all work together. Unfortunately, before I come here to talk to you guys, I asked my friends in Egypt on the ground, I said, what do you want to say to the people there? And I'm going to be in a big meeting with a lot of well-known people in the United States, and they influential as well. They said, Mohammed, some of them, they took it as a sarcastic thing. They said, you know, American government, the American who are the one without killing us, without United States, without the aid, without the support from the government, we won't have a military coup. We'll have a better life. I just said, and then thank you to Code Pink and Medea being a partner on Operation Surly and other things. So we were able to show them the other picture of the Americans. I said, you know, the American administration, the White House, the military, American military is not the American people. So I showed them Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. Medea spoke a lot in Jazeera, I spoke a lot in Arabic 21st. So they saw the other image of America. So my concern or my suggestion to you today, what we can do is, before we concentrate on the climate change, let's focus on the people of Egypt, and we can be a role model to free those people. I don't know if Sharif talk about right now, because the Egyptian regime know that people are starting getting ready to move in the street for peaceful demonstration. They are arresting thousands of Egyptians right now. We have a lot of Egyptians right now behind bars because they're thinking to go at 11-11, November 11, the day that Biden visiting Egypt, to so they're going out to the street. So preparing to that, Sisi is starting to arrest the people. So what I'm trying to say today, what we can do, each one in that call have a lot of members living in different states, can talk to the Congress members and their own Congress member, pass that letter, because you guys could think a sign on it, and they can pass it and make it press to put pressure on the White House to make the visit conditional. Trust me, he can. Sisi recognition to him, he's afraid of two things, the international community and especially United States and the Egyptian military. He doesn't afraid of the Egyptian people, since he has a military and he has a power in his hand. But if the Egyptian people moved in the street with the support of the international community, and I'm talking in particular United States, will be able to move and have actions. So again, what I'm thinking is, we're having a protest in front of the White House, I think starting on the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th. So I'm asking everybody who can join the protest in Washington, D.C. would be great. If anybody can take that letter and change it to petition and pass it on to the Congress member, to the State Department, to the White House, we'll really appreciate it. I'm going to take any message from here today, and I'll pass it on to the people of Egypt. I talk a lot in the Egyptian and the Arab media, and I have an interview tomorrow with the Arabic 21st. And also Alan from PDA had an interview yesterday. He talked very well about support the people of Egypt. So that's very much it. I wanted to just give very much short messages, because I saw a lot of people here and I don't want to take a lot of your time. And thank you very much, Medea and Marcy and Jody And Dorothy, everybody I know from Code Pink, because you guys, the first NGO or first organization that have the courage to stand against Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, stand against the White House, the administration, when they support that brutal regime. Thank you very much for having
me. Thank you. Thank you so much, Mohammed. Questions. All right, Medea, want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. Sharif, you said that you could talk more about the military's role in environmental destruction. If you could talk about that, that would be great.
Well, aside from, you know, the obvious problems with having such a massive weapons arsenal, because Egypt essentially, solidifies international ties through these massive weapons purchases of weapons that no one else wants. And, we take on these massive loans to purchase them. But aside from that, so at the COP, there'll be things, environmental activities that are, will be allowed to be spoken about, okay? So there'll be trash collection, recycling, renewable energy, and obviously climate finance, which, you know, is a big issue for Egypt and the Global South. But environmental issues that implicate the government and the military will not be tolerated, okay? So industrial pollution, let me just back up for a second. People have to understand the military in Egypt is entrenched in every part of the Egyptian state and is very heavily entrenched in its economy. So, military-owned enterprises produce everything from baby formula to fertilizer to cement. They're the largest landowner. They operate hotels. Any kind of industrial pollution or environmental harm from real estate, tourism development, or agribusiness, all things that the military is very heavily invested in and profits from, will not be tolerated. Issues like coal, I mean, everyone can agree that coal is something that is very easy to be critical of, but that will be off limits too, because Egyptian coal imports, much of it purchased actually from the United States, have risen over the past several years, driven by very strong demand from the cement sector, so to power cement factories. And actually, Egypt's largest importer of coal is also its largest cement producer, and that's the El Arish Cement Company. And that was built in 2016 by none other than the Egyptian military. We've seen massive amounts of cement being poured into Egypt's natural environment. Over the past several years, the government has built nearly 1,000 new bridges and tunnels, destroying acres and acres and acres of green space and cutting down thousands of trees. They've gone on this crazy construction spree, building a slew of new cities, including a new administrative capital in the desert east of Cairo. Egypt's also Africa's second largest gas producer, and it's actively scaling up its oil and gas production and exports, again, which military and military intelligence is heavily involved in. So these are just some ways that the military is very invested in various forms of power and energy that are harmful to the environment. And so those things will be off the agenda, and any kind of climate financing won't, any kind of reparations won't be channeled towards, tackling those issues.
Thank you. Sharif, you've really given us a very detailed picture of how deeply entrenched the military is in every aspect of Egyptian society. You know, I think we each have to act in our own, within our own sphere of influence, but also in terms of what we can do, where our reach is. After I finish this, I'm going to go on Twitter and I'm going to tweet to the U.S. ambassador to Egypt that I want, whoever this person is, Mohammed probably knows, I want this person to speak up and speak out and demand that these political prisoners be released. Some of you may go to the Egyptian embassy. Others, hopefully, you're all signing on to that petition that will be delivered. We've all got to do what we can do, right?
Thank you so much to our guests. You can follow Sharif's work in The Intercept, among other outlets and locations. You can follow Mohammed's work on Twitter at MOHAMED71935373. It is really grim to hear from our guests about this current repression. Those of us who are listening from outside of Egypt, especially those of us living in the belly of the beast that is sending billions in military aid to Egypt, the United States. We need to be calling for justice, accountability for all this military aid, and demand that political prisoners be released. To learn more about Code Pink's upcoming solidarity actions this week and next across the United States, you can view our website at codepink.org/events. Thank you so much for listening to Code Pink Radio.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Danny Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more. It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
Code pink for freedom. Code pink for peace. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger. They curtail our speech, our movement, our rights, but we won't give up.
We're about to fight.
With the wave of the flag, our liberty shrink. They say code fear.
We say code pain. With the
wave. Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. What is the antithesis of the ocean? The desert, it would seem. I recently traveled to Egypt, purported to be the driest, least rainy country in the world. Rain averages 0.1 inch a year. Snow rarely falls in the mountains of the Sinai. The country is a sliver of water, edged in green from a delta on the Mediterranean south into the heart of Africa, the Nile, the longest river in the world, from its source in Burundi, flowing north to Alexandria, where it joins an inland sea. The edges are thin and fragile, vulnerable to flood prior to the construction of the great dam at Aswan that controls the water, even as it caused great historic monuments to be moved to higher ground. All the habitation and agriculture of the modern nation is clustered there. The monuments, some dating back to 5000 BC, and the ensuing tombs of the pharaohs indicate that not much has changed. The pyramids at Giza rise up out of the sand, uncanny geometrical sandstone forms seemingly impervious to time. The Great Sphinx, constructed around 2000 BC, stares into the sun and wind, a man's head, no wings, with an eroded perplexion, as if wondering, why me? Why here, of all places? The cultural artifacts did not disappoint. The burial treasures are mostly removed to museums in Cairo, but the tombs are an astonishing compendium of knowledge amassed and recorded by a caste of scribes who carved into the walls, in complicated relief, documents, all aspects of daily life, the rituals and beliefs, the science and medicine, the forms of harvest and sustenance, the great ceremonies that characterize the pharaonic periods. The realization that such a level of civilization existed so long ago is profound. The divisions of rich and poor, the challenges of living in a harsh climate, the rise and fall of autocrats sent shivers of recognition to this 21st century tourist. How is it different? Inequities, tyranny, vast engineering achievement, science opening the world to unimaginable possibilities, transitory nature of life, desert reflection. Around all this is a turning of endless sand and horizon. If it was blue, it would be the ocean. There are waves and crests of sand. There are patterns on the surface made by the wind, sandy spindrift lifted and blown. For infinite water, there is infinite rock and gravel and mineral grit that circulates in patterns that cannot easily be anticipated or passed over as they are so ephemeral that they offer nothing to hold on to, no marks by which to guide one's way. Lost in the desert, lost at sea, lost. It's impossible not to connect these views with climate. That desertification is one terrible consequence of increasing drought, declining river volumes, and the loss of once fertile ground. What would happen to Egypt if the present trends of heat and storm and climate consequence remained unchecked and carried on with a relentless transformation to dry, dead ground in which nothing can grow? The desert is a dead zone. There is biodiversity there, numerous examples of algae, birds and animals, many insects, grasses and plants, and a remarkable range of over 2,200 species of fungi and lichens. The Pharaoh's physicians knew about such things. They discovered ways to live in such a climate, to thrive and survive, to build monuments, make glorious art and artifact, and feed and heal themselves, whether pharaohs, citizens, priests, or slaves. Historical research suggests that in 2500 BC, the population of Egypt was 1.6 million. Today, census figures indicate over 100 million still clustered along the Nile in a land that is 96% desert and rapidly losing habitable land to global warming, urbanization, lost wetlands, saltwater intrusion, and more desert evermore. Look around. The facts are the same. Statistics are similar. The threats are universal. Standing there comes to mind the famous Shelley verse from his great poem Ozymandias, a reflection that pertains and cannot be denied. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public